Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-3074, United States of America versus Jerome Hampton, also known as Jay Appellant. Mr. Ree for Appellant, Ms. Kurt for Appellee.
Mr. Ree, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Christopher Ree on behalf of the appellant, Jerome Hampton. Your Honors, like the case that the Court decided last year, United States versus Moore, this case is about the extent to which that the government in a criminal trial can implant its view of the case in the mind of the jury through an agent of the FBI who worked on the case. There's no dispute in this case that an FBI agent can give lay opinion testimony about wiretap recordings if he's interpreting code words that have hidden meaning. There's also no dispute that an FBI agent can also offer expert testimony about slang terminology that is common in the drug industry. But when it comes to interpreting plain English words, when you have an agent telling the jury what inferences they should draw to provide context for conversations, every circuit that has considered this question has rejected the government's position and has ruled that such opinion testimony lacks a proper foundation under the rules of evidence. Every circuit has also ruled that this kind of an error is not harmless. And we refer to the Second Circuit opinions in the Greenwich case, the Eighth Circuit opinion in the Peoples case, and the Fourth Circuit opinion in the Johnson case. All of the cases cited by the government refer to these code language kind of situations, but it's important that we understand that in this case, the FBI agent, Special Agent Bevington, repeatedly was permitted to testify about plain English exchanges. Have you talked? I'm going to tell you everything that's been going on. I pay my man $5,000. In those cases, he was allowed to describe what is going on in the mind of the speaker. He was allowed to say, when the speaker is referring to your brother or my man, he's talking about Jerome Hampton. When he says, when I tell you, I'm going to tell you what's been going on, he's really going to describe his drug operation to Mr. Hampton. And obviously, having an FBI agent offer that kind of an opinion is very prejudicial to the defense, because the jury is going to sit there and hear that opinion and necessarily think, this FBI agent knows something about the case that I do, that I don't. And this FBI agent has been listening to all the calls in the case. He's been investigating the case for years. And it effectively puts a thumb on the scale for the government. It allows them to tilt the evidence in their favor. And one thing I think the court has to struggle with, if the court wants to rule in favor for the government, is what sort of door that opens. Does it, for instance, allow the defense to call their own lay witness who listens to all the recordings and offers his own competing interpretation of recordings? And is that really helpful for the jury? Because again, under 701, the questions the court has to ask itself is the opinion rationally based on the witness's perception?
Interrupt you. It's common practice in prosecutions under the Internal Revenue Code for an IRS special agent to sit at counsel table. And then at the end of the government's case, the agent is called to the stand and testifies, summarizes the evidence. Now, some people think that that gives the government two closing arguments and whether it's proper or not. But some courts have upheld that. The one thing that is not allowed, however, is for that summary witness to get up on the stand and start testifying about things that were never put in evidence. And I understood your argument to be that there were 20,000 different recordings, either telephone calls or in the van or whatever. Mm-hmm. Only 61 of them were introduced into evidence, and the agent testified that he heard all of the material and that his testimony was based on all the material. Therefore, his testimony was based on information that was not in evidence in the case.
Your Honor, I agree with you that is what the officer, the agent, said in this case, and I think one of the reasons why it's so problematic and prejudicial for the defense is because of, under a harmless error analysis, I think the jury is going to infer what they want to infer from the case. I don't think that even if the agent had limited himself to only the evidence that was before the jury. And even if the agent said, look, I'm only going to tell you about the 61 recordings that you've heard, and my opinion is based solely on those 61 recordings, it still would have been an improper opinion, because it is still an FBI agent telling the jury, essentially, this is how you should interpret the evidence. It's the government being able to give a running commentary throughout the course of the case.
I understand that, but I guess my question is, why do we even have to reach that? If in fact you're correct that the agent improperly testified about matters that were not in evidence.
Well, I certainly agree with you that to me the most problematic thing about this case was obviously what the agent said on cross-examination when he was asked, you know, couldn't anyone interpret the case differently? And he said, well, if they didn't know other things about the investigation and other conversations, maybe, but anyone who's listened to all the calls and is aware of all the conversations would agree with me. That is obviously the crux of our harmless error argument. We believe that's a highly prejudicial statement because the jury is likely to infer from that this agent knows things about this case that we simply don't. He's listened to the whole case. He's been investigating it for 2 years. We should trust him. When he says that this tape means that they're referring to Jerome Hampton, we should defer to his judgment here. Obviously, it puts the defense in a very difficult position. And it's very prejudicial, even if there's nothing to back it up, even if there's no evidence outside the record that is actually harmful to Mr. Hampton.
Could the agent here have testified about the context as long as he didn't draw the inference for the jury?
He could certainly answer factual questions, and I'll give you an example, Your Honor, where I think gets to what you're getting at. With respect to Activation 100, which was I pay my man $5,000 every time 10 of these come in, he was asked a question during direct examination, which is a perfectly legitimate question, which is, Agent Bevington, during the course of your investigation, did the government determine that anyone other than Mr. Hampton was receiving shipments from Linnell Glover? That is a perfectly valid question. His answer was no. In fact, the only person we found that was receiving shipments was Jerome Hampton. Obviously, the jury then has the tape recording. It has the agent's truthful statement about what the government discovered in its investigation. The jury can draw that inference. Obviously, the prosecutor in its opening statement and in its closing argument can urge the jury to draw the inference they want them to draw, which is namely, the only person who's receiving shipments here is Mr. Hampton. And so therefore, you put two and two together, the jury can draw their own conclusion. Again, what was improper here is that Agent Bevington was allowed to go one step further and was allowed to say, well, I think what's really going on in this conversation is that he's referring to Mr. Hampton when he says my man. And we know that my man is not a special term. It doesn't have a coded meaning. In fact, in one of the other recordings, Activation 83, which is cited on page 9 of the government's brief, he refers to my man as being Anthony Suggs. He says, you know, I got an issue with my man. Juju's getting it from my man. And there the government says he's referring to Anthony Suggs. And so allowing the government agent to get up there and, again, narrate these recordings and tell the jury what conclusions they should reach when it comes to interpreting plain English language, words that anyone can listen to and draw their own conclusions about, that doesn't meet the test of 701.
Did the jury know that there were more than 61 recordings?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
How did the jury know that?
When Agent Bevington first took the stand, the very first part of his testimony was walking Agent Bevington through each of the wiretaps in the case and how many recordings were made. And he was specifically asked the question, did he listen to all the recordings? He said, I listened to every recording on the Suggs telephone. I listened to every recordings on the Linnell Glover telephone. I listened to every recording in the van. And he was asked, well, how many recordings is that in total? He said there were 20,000, about 20,000 more or so activations. So the government made a point of drawing that out, that there was a much larger pool of recordings here and that Agent Bevington had spent the time and energy listening to every single one of those recordings.
Once he does that, I'm not really clear how, if he was confined to testimony only about the 61 recordings, I'm not sure how he could do that, because he's now got a background information on 20,000 calls, and if only 61 come into evidence, I don't know how the mind could possibly work to say, just confine your impressions or your opinion to what you learned from the 61 calls. I mean, that seems to me impossible.
Well, I understand that concern, and obviously the focus of our argument is not on, you know, did he have adequate, you know, was he relying on this call or that call when he was answering the question. The focus of our argument is on, was there an adequate basis every time he offered an opinion? What was he offering an opinion about? And again, it is permissible for him to offer an opinion about words that have coded meaning. There's no dispute about that. If we're talking about words, the government recently cited to the Glover case. In the Glover case, when they talked about PCP, they didn't refer to 16 and 32. They referred to 16th Street and 32nd Street. And Agent Bevington said, I've listened to a lot of these recordings, and I can tell you my opinion based on these recordings is that when they're talking about 16th Street, they're really talking about 16 ounces of PCP. And when they're talking about 32nd Street, obviously they're talking about 32 ounces of PCP.
So even though he wasn't qualified as an expert here, you wouldn't object to his expert testimony, basically, about the slang or what certain words mean?
Well, we would object, Your Honor, because the government expressly said we weren't going to have him testify in an expert fashion, and then they went ahead and did that. But that, again, is not the thrust of our main argument. Regardless of whether he had been certified as an expert, the terms that he was testifying about that we object to, your brother, I'll tell you what's been going on, I pay my man $5,000, these are not terms that either an expert or a lay witness has any special knowledge about what the speakers mean. And to use an FBI agent in the fashion that the government did is problematic. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Suzanne Kurt on behalf of the United States of America. The question for the court that's presented here is whether Judge Hogan abused his substantial discretion in letting this testimony in. If the court concludes it did, however, reversal is not required because the testimony that's in question here was not a substantial part of the government's case, as I will explain later. Furthermore, the evidence against appellant was extremely strong, and the remaining evidence only served to corroborate the opinions that Special Agent Bevington gave. I want to address your concerns first. It is true that the jury did learn that there was a large number of recordings that came into evidence during this investigation, and of course the government did not introduce all of those. I do believe that the number 22,000 may have come out during cross-examination. I'm not certain of that fact, but the government did establish that he listened to all the recordings. However, the government was very careful. If you look at each instance of a testimony that is challenged here, specifically the three that are listed in the brief, you will see that when the government asked Special Agent Bevington to offer his opinion, in each instance, Special Agent Bevington confined himself to facts that were before the jury. He explained very specific facts. Unlike Greenidge and some other cases on which appellant relies on, Special Agent Bevington did not tell the jury, I am basing my opinions here on everything that I learned during this investigation and the entire investigation. There was one particular instance that appellant relies on during cross-examination where Special Agent Bevington, in response to a defense question as to the call in which he opined that Glover was going to tell Mr. Hampton about the Suggs search warrant. During cross,
it seems to me that you're contradicting yourself. In your brief, if you would get your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
On the one hand, on page 50.
50, Your Honor?
Yes, so yes. In the second full paragraph. It's clear that you say that Bevington explained the basis for his opinion, and it is clear they were not based on facts not before the jury.
Yes.
Yeah. And yet, on page 39 of your brief, you say that the agent's impressions were based on his having listened to all of the wiretapped calls. That's 20,000. And on page 42 of your
brief. I'm sorry, Your Honor, where are you? I'm sorry, could
top.
You, at the top.
See that?
Yes, I do see that.
And on page 42, you say the same.
Well, I'm referring to the wire.
The prosecutor told the court that Bevington had listened to all of the calls, had done their surveillance, and that his opinion was based on the investigation. So not only Bevington himself, mm-hmm. but also the prosecutor, in sponsoring his testimony, told the court that Bevington's impressions were based on material that was not in evidence, namely all of the calls.
But Your Honor, I agree that those statements were made. But if you look at the actual testimony that is being challenged in this case, number one, the telephone call regarding the Suggs search warrant, the statement about my man that I'm paying $5,000 to is Hampton, and the statement about 32 meant he was asking for PCP when Velma Williams arrived. If you look at each of those in detail, you will see that when Special Agent Bevington testified, he related it specifically to facts in the case. Although those statements may have been made by the court and the prosecutors early on, when the testimony actually came out, it was definitely confined to the evidence.
I guess my problem with that is that he doesn't have, once it's said that my impressions are based on 20,000 calls, only 61 of which are in evidence, once that is out, he does everything he testifies to for the rest of the trial. You don't have to keep repeating it. The jury has the impression this guy knows a heck of a lot more than we do.
Your Honor, I don't think that Special Agent Bevington ever told that, did tell that to the jury. Now, I did want to get to the one point that came out on cross-examination that I began discussing. Now, this claim that told the jury about matters that were not before it should be reviewed by this court, if for anything, for plain error, because that was not the claim that was raised below. And when Special Agent Bevington, in response to repeated pressing by the defense, said he was asked an opinion, actually, about his opinion. Do you think anybody would disagree with your opinion? And he stated to the defense counsel, no, if they had listened to all of the calls and all of the conversation. Defense counsel never asked for that response to be stricken from the record. He did not ask the underlying opinion to be stricken from the record, and he did not ask Special Agent Bevington to clarify what it was that he was talking about. And Agent Bevington had just testified that his statement about the Suggs search warrant was based on the immediately preceding activities and all of the calls that had gone on between Mr. Suggs and Mr. Glover before Mr. Hampton called him.
Were they in evidence?
Yes, and those had all. So I think if the court takes a very particular look at the evidence that's being challenged in this case, you'll see that when the government offered it, it was based on very specific facts, and none of the opinions did Special Agent Bevington say, "I'm basing this on a lot of all this other testimony that that you haven't heard." Granted, he was the case agent; we acknowledge that, but we took pains to cabin our evidence. And I think proof of that is by the fact that early on the government told the court that it specifically instructed Special Agent Bevington not to offer any opinion that was based on debriefs of cooperators, because obviously that would be inadmissible testimony that wasn't before the jury. And I think the government did take care to do this.
How do you I'm sorry, go ahead.
What about counsel's complaint that Agent Bevington actually drew inferences that should have been left to the jury and that this was improper under 701?
We completely disagree that is improper under 701. There is 701 allows opinion testimony, It does not bar opinion testimony that goes to the ultimate issue. As a matter of fact, the rule by itself states that it has to be on a matter that it must be helpful to a matter that is at issue. So it's opinions, and it's allowed by the rule. The rule is extremely broad, and Rule 704 doesn't even restrict opinions that may go to the ultimate issue. So there's no case that has stated that number one, it needs to be restricted only to code words, and we think a lot of the language here was coded. And this court in Smith did not reach that conclusion. In Smith, Special Agent Bevington stated that Mr. Glover and another co-defendant were working together, pooling their money together to go to New York and buy heroin. And that statement was not found to be in violation of Rule 701 in that particular case. And if you look at the claims that were raised by the defendant in Smith and in his brief, you will see that almost the same arguments that were made here were made in Smith, including the reliance on the Second Circuit case in Greenwich. And that was not accepted by this court. We think that this court's opinion in Smith and the Rollins case that we rely on and that Judge Hogan relied on allowed the very particular testimony in this case. I would like, however, to stress that this evidence that we're talking about here was not a major part of the government's case, although appellant would have you think otherwise. I think the proof of that is even looking at the government's closing arguments and rebuttal. Never once did we suggest to the jury that they should accept certain facts because Special Agent Bevington said so. Of course, we talked about the calls, the testimony, and the evidence, but we did not rely in particular, call the jury's attention to his opinion in the closing. Secondly, many of the things that were offered as an opinion were confirmed by other witnesses, particularly call 100, the call where Coolidge Bell, between Coolidge Bell and Glover, where Special Agent Bevington opined that my man was Appellant Hampton. Well, because he was paying him $5,000 per 10-gallon shipment. Well, Velma Williams said the same thing. Glover complained to her that Hampton was charging him $5,000 per shipment. So that was duplicative of other evidence. Finally, the last part of the testimony that he complains about is the 32 and asking for the appellant asking for 32 and whether that's PCP or not. Well, that testimony was completely allowable under Smith, whether 32 means PCP or not. But Velma Williams stated that 32 was one way of describing a particular quantity of PCP in 32 bottles, in 32-ounce bottles. And the evidence in this case, apart from Bevington, was completely compelling. The tapes and the overhears in the truck owned by Glover were very damning. The testimony of Velma Williams was completely incriminating, and let's also talk about Mr. Skinner, the FedEx driver who was actually present during the deliveries and made it plain that it was appellant who was the one who was asking for the packages on the occasion of the second delivery. And he also made it plain that it was appellant who signed for the packages on all the occasions.
Did he deny that? Did Hampton deny that?
Yes, he did. In certain portions, he denied.
He denied as being the one who accepted the package?
I think at one point he may have testified not for the second delivery, but for the first delivery. I think at one point, and my memory is not completely clear on this, about something about his brother. But the facts show that a J. Anderson was the one who signed for the delivery on the first occasion, and if we'll remember, right before that delivery was supposed to happen, he had given his business card to Mr. Glover and Velma Williams. And even though he had given his business card, which obviously has his name on it, he then called and said to Glover, I want to put a name with my card. I think it's fair inference, as we argued to the jury, that he didn't want his name on that delivery, and that's why it said J. Anderson, and that's who signed for that particular delivery, to whom it was addressed. And for the second set of delivery, of course, it was on videotape. And his version of what happened there was completely contradicted by the professional 20-year FedEx driver who absolutely denied that that he insisted that appellant accept the packages for him. He made it very plain that appellant came out to the car after he was getting ready to leave and asked for the packages for $96.20. The facts, apart from Special Agent Bevington's testimony in this case, were extremely compelling. And I see I'm well out of time, so unless the court has other questions, I would be happy to address them. I would ask that the court find that there was no abuse of discretion here, but if there was a problem, it was certainly harmless. And I would like to thank the court very much for its time and ask it to affirm the conviction.
Just make sure I understand one thing that you're
yes, Your Honor.
Arguing. Wilson, in your mind, is not applicable in saying that he should have been qualified as an expert and not allowed to testify under 701?
Wilson makes it plain that Wilson's first case where the court made the dichotomy of 701 and 702. Mm-hmm. And in Wilson, under Wilson, Special Agent Bevington, and Wilson came out after this trial. Wilson makes it clear now that Special Agent Bevington could have testified as a lay witness under 701 for matters that he learned during the course of the investigation. But he also could have testified as an expert concerning...
Yeah, I'm not sure we're looking at the same case. I thought the court said it was error in allowing him to testify.
Yes, but not
701.
But not for facts that were learned during the course of an investigation, only for expert testimony. And it's now clear that an agent can testify in both capacities in the same case, and that is not error. That can be done. Thank you, Your Honor. I thank the court for its time.
I don't think you had any time left, but we'll give you some time to respond.
One factual statement I'd like to correct for the record. Mr. Hampton never used a false name when he signed for these packages. If you look at Appendix 1020 and 1048, all the signatures on all the packages, as you'll see, reflect a Hampton or a J. Hampton. Some of the addressees on the packages, which of course Mr. Hampton did not control how they were addressed, used different names, but Mr. Hampton did not use a false name when he signed for any of the packages. And the only other thing I'd like to address is the contention that somehow the exchange enduring cross-examination should be subject to plain error review because of the fact that the defense did not move to strike that statement. By the time that exchange occurred, this issue had already been discussed with the court and objections had been lodged on four separate occasions, every single time the court had shot down the defense. And so it would have been completely futile at that point for the defense to object yet again to the way that this testimony was going. We believe under the circumstances, clearly the error was preserved by the defense and that harmless error.
You cite a case from this circuit in a footnote saying that you don't have to keep objecting.
That's correct.
Keep lodging the same objection over and over. Yeah.
Okay.
Can I ask you about Smith? Because I think Peoples supports your argument, but I think Smith may support the government.
Okay.
And that's our case.
Well, I understand Smith is the case. Your Honor, Smith is clearly a case, and I want to make sure we're talking. There are two aspects of Smith that are relevant here. One aspect is about testimony that was clearly expert testimony, where Agent Bevington talked about, we got that covered.
Got that.
The other statement was about, it was overview testimony, and the statement was, you know, these guys are getting together to go to New York to sell drugs. The objection that was lodged in that case was an 802 objection. It was an objection based strictly on the fact that he was relying on hearsay. And the Moore case covers the issue of overview testimony generally and says that for putting aside the Smith objection for 802, overview testimony is problematic for a different reason, because it allows the government to implant its view of the case in the jury's mind. And that, we think, is exactly what's gone on here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.